In Psalm 37, we have established that fretting because of evildoers is a parallel to being envious of wrongdoers. Fret or getting angry is to envy or in some way wish you have what they have, or in most cases appear to have. Envy is jealousy, and anger is not far behind. The psalmist reminds the reader, psalmist is David, that those who are so envied and fretted about are going to fade soon, like the grass. Well, some may say, so am I. But the difference is what happens next after the fading that's really important. And that gives you a proper perspective on the way things are, not the way they appear. Though David writes to the righteous, he also is writing to the wicked. And I believe he's trying to change their minds. The ones that are righteous have a relationship with God. The ones who are wicked do not. You see these two general categories throughout the Psalms, especially Psalm 1, of someone either having a relationship with God or with themselves alone, or maybe some would even call them practical atheists. We were also before talking about replacement of those undesirable behaviors, to say the least, with godly behavior, and to do that even though it seems like doing so isn't getting you where you want to be. And in Psalm 37, we see the frustration of that, and the anger, and the fretting, and the wasted effort in envying or fretting about those things. There's often this tension for those who try to live by faith and do what's right and be right before God, and the outcome and the results in life that they experience, and between what they perceive is happening in the lives of the wicked. I mean, they're trying and trying hard. They want to be right with God. They want to do right. And they just don't seem to be getting any place. As far as how one measures that sort of thing in this life. And I think that all of us who are honest before God will admit that we have seen this, perceived this, and it seems incredibly unfair. And it's far too simplistic to counter that sort of a statement with the old adage that life's not fair, however true that is. Such a piece of advice or a counter to the mindset regarding equity in life isn't very helpful, and it amounts to telling someone just simply not to look for fair in life. So stopping that mindset's the remedy for the righteous. Stopping it in its tracks is admonished in Psalm 37. And again, immersing oneself in righteous, godly behavior is prescribed. It's quite interesting that the practical atheist, the wicked one, does not give God any more than a nod in this life, if even that much, and seemingly does well anyhow. That's the problem. That's the issue here. In fact, God may be considered irrelevant by a wicked person. How do you square that with, you know, the situation being like it is? Without getting into the source of the seeming prosperity of the wicked, David reminds of the temporary position of the wicked. I wonder if that makes any difference to you or to me or to the righteous ones. It's supposed to. That doesn't actually change anything about the absurdity of such an upside-down scenario even if it is only temporary. And we might even quibble who's to say about that. Now, there will be other wicked ones who prosper, even if the ones we know and see are just temporary. I mean, there'll be others come along down the pike, temporarily or not. While the wicked seem to do so well in this world, or in this economy, and I mean by that the way things work, it seems prevalent. Why else would you speak of it in such universal types? Because that's what David does. And that's talking about some neighbor of yours or people you've known in your life. He's talking generally about the difference between the wicked and the righteous. I don't know that David ever thought that what he wrote would make everything all better. You know, like your mommy. For the righteous ones, it doesn't make things all better. But what he wrote are facts, and it's easier to deal with facts than it is to deal with someone's perception of what they think is a fact. Perceptions can mislead, whereas facts establish a basis to formulate conclusions that are not illusory and, of course, not grounded in reality. To say 37:2, to be specific here for a moment, that the wicked will fade as grass is to speak of an entire group rather than one wicked person or a subset of all the wicked, as well as to place the fading in the future. Remember that in Hebrew, the action of a verb is either complete or incomplete, called perfect or imperfect. But this word, nasal, does not refer really to naturally fading away, which is what the translation seems to indicate. Rather, it speaks of becoming clipped. The word nasal is to be clipped, circumcised, and cut down, as in a branch or a tree or even grass in this case. So it hasn't happened yet, but there will be action taken to cut down or clip the wicked, like one cuts down grass. And remember, this is in David's time and not with the equipment we have today. So it's pretty violent when a sickle comes along and cuts grass. It's pretty knee-jerk, I would say. Pretty abrupt. So they don't fade away slowly and painlessly, but are cut down quickly, decisively, and deliberately. And no subject is supplied, just that the actions are coming against them, and as yet, today, are incomplete, or at least the time of David's writings, we see it today as being incomplete as well. But one day, that will be the way that it is. The action will be completed. Thus, the admonition of 37:4 and the results of that are prescribed by Holy Spirit as he writes through David, which are said to transform the heart of the righteous so that he does not or she does not fret about or envy wicked people any longer. This is that replacement idea, but it's also a transformational idea. You have in your heart something that is a perception, and a wrong perception, that God is setting about to transform. And so the admonition of 37:4 is how Yahweh will change the desires of one's heart. Delight yourself in the Lord. So the undesired waste of brain power and passions, envy and fretting over the wicked, are now being replaced, which is actually another imperfect verb. It's going on. It's happening even now. And that causes you, helps you, puts glasses on you that help you to see them like Yahweh does, and even to think about them like He thinks about them. All that plus 37:5 through 11 is supposed to be our response when anger, frustration, temptation to envy, getting agitated about this strange way that things seem to be in this upside down world. The world we live in may be upside down now, but it will not always be so, according to verse 5. Just as tenaciously as Yahweh opposes the wicked, He upholds the righteous. Holy Spirit promises that it won't always be like this. There is coming a time, and I'll leave the rest of that sentence go. Three more sections in this psalm will complete our brief study of Psalm 37. The first is 37:12 through 20, and it contains some insights regarding the situation for now. This section introduces another aspect of wickedness that hasn't been mentioned so far. The wicked will use their success to oppose and even assault the righteous ones. You see this in Psalm 37:12 and 14. Oh boy, they're not only prospering, but now they're going to use their prospering to attack and assault the righteous ones? Yeah, happens every day. This is giving you a real, honest, clear look at the way that the world is. We are, of course, to be able to handle that in a godly way. But that doesn't mean that we're hung out to dry, just because that's the way that it is for now. It only makes sense, actually, when you think about it. And even as you look at the landscape today, that's how it is. The people who are in power seemingly do not want the righteous around. There's a fly in their soup and we're it. Now the Lord, as far as all that's concerned, has already taken sides. According to the verse 13, He's already fixed the end of this conflict as well. I mean, fixed the end of the conflict, fixed it as to how it's going to come out. All the hostilities of the wicked will come around again only against them, and they are doomed to perish, according to verse 20. Not only that, but Yahweh sustains the righteous as He breaks the arms of the wicked. That's a pretty strong contrast. But even now, regardless of one's perception, the righteous are better off, according to verse 16, in God's economy and in the world, today, right now. And it has nothing to do with how much one possesses. Rather, it's about the quality, I think, of what they possess and how they received it, how they obtained it. There is greater satisfaction in one scenario than the other. There is gratitude without all the noise and in having just what you need. It is seen as a gift, while the other is seen as something you did for yourself. or you obtained it because you deserved it somehow. Others are, you know, about that. Now that I think about it, you know, people think they worked hard to get these things. People think that they have to work hard, therefore, in order to keep these things and to get more. So that's where all the clamoring comes from. Others are always clamoring for what you have when you are the wicked. Other clamoring takes place in you as you try to protect what you have. Make sure you can keep it. More is needed, of course, to replace anything that you use or even to add to what you already have, which is always the case because you always have to have more, 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 more. That's a human trait. Something wired within us. God provides in the case of the righteous so that no worries are necessary, no clamoring for things. He sustains the righteous and he eliminates all that clamoring and worry. Verse 19 says, even in famine is there security and promise from the Lord for the righteous. The inheritance is secure in verse 17, where again the arms of the wicked will be broken. How with broken arms will they hold all that they think they possess? There's great contrast between the two groups of people. One has the false promises of material wealth, while the other has the promise of the great I Am. Let me ask you, which one's better? That's up to the individual, of course. I mean, we can say one thing or another, but really, I'm not saying that there's no objective truth, but one has to choose which one is better and choose which way they'll go. But one is clearly better. But people still make a decision about which one she or he pursues in life. And that sets a course for them according to what they value. One leads to losing it all in the end, the other leads to owning it all in the end and enjoying it forever. For it's never going to vanish or prove to be an illusion, like vapor or smoke into the atmosphere. Now, if these words were coming from any other source, I would be very doubtful about them. But because they come from Yahweh, I'm convinced of their truthfulness. So we'll stop there for this week, and until we see each other again, Lord willing, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance on you and give you shalom, peace. Bye for now.